Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Pseudo Intellectual Live. And a big thank you, especially to everyone who is joining us live. And a reminder, for those of you who like podcasts, we are available on all the podcast platforms. So feel free to check us out over there, subscribe, download, give us a good rating, however podcasts work. I'm more of a video person. But today we have a very cool guest, someone who, this is actually my first time speaking with him, even though I've been following him for a while. I'm sure you've at least heard of this gentleman, Owen Schroyer. He is a journalist, free speech advocate, as well as the host of InfoWars War Room. Owen, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's nice to finally talk to you. You know, we both kind of emerged on the scene in U.S. politics at the same time. It's been a wild ride, hasn't it?
No, for sure. Especially watching your career unfold. You're one of those people who you've actually kind of become in some ways the story yourself. I want to talk to you about it because you have this kind of ongoing court case and these legal issues pertaining to January 6th. And I think that's one of the instances where we can kind of point you broadly and say, yeah, regardless of what your political views are, you should be able to acknowledge that a lot of the aftermath from that day has been politically motivated. But can you kind of keep people aware or bring people up to speed as to what exactly happened to you on January 6th and the legal troubles you've been facing since then? Because it's a fascinating story, although also a terrifying one.
Well, I've told this story so many times now, I think I can give you a pretty condensed version to try to get all the proper context in line here, because there's a lot of different details that people need to understand to get the full context. The U.S. government specifically has been after me since 2019, when Jerry Nadler was hosting a Trump impeachment hearing. And I stood up and disrupted it and said that Trump was innocent, that the Democrats were the ones committing the crimes. They were just doing this as political persecution against Trump. And the whole ordeal lasted about less than 60 seconds. I stood up, stated my piece when the cops came and took me. This is very standard stuff. Hearings get disrupted all the time. And what normally happens, the normal standard protocols is the cops will remove you from the room. They'll detain you for a minute. And they'll walk you outside, and normally they'll say, you're banned from this building for 24 hours. Now go about your merry way.
We see leftists, by the way, do this all the time. Leftist activists, protesters.
I mean, the climate change protesters, the pussy hat wearers, you name it, the gun control people. David Hogg specifically is probably the best case to juxtapose against mine. So very common stuff, the common protocol, unless you resist arrest or assault a police officer, which I didn't. They detain you for a moment, release you from the building, say 24 hours, you're banned. You come back, we'll arrest you, but go about your merry way. Well, I was about to be sent on my merry way by the Capitol Police when the chief who is there detaining me that day gets a buzz on his walkie, walks away, and comes back and says, we've been told we have to arrest you. Now, I can only speculate as to where that order came down from. I would say probably the top of the Democrat Party, maybe Nancy Pelosi. So long story short, I get arrested for that day, spend that day in prison, end up with charges. I'm going in and out of court dealing with that. Now, I'll explain why this is all relevant to the January 6th case coming up. Now, all of this would have been behind me. I had to serve some probation. I had to do some community service hours. All would have been done. All would have been behind me. But I could never get this case cleared from the docket because when COVID shut everything down, the courts were shut down. So this thing was just kind of sitting out there, and I was technically on this DC probation. Now, I'll say this before I advance to the January 6th portion. When we went to the judge to first be in front of a judge for these charges that I was facing, disruption of Congress, the prosecuting attorney, the first judge we went into, the first courtroom, the prosecuting attorney wanted me to be banned from D.C., banned, completely banned for a very common occurrence of disrupting Congress. Right. Now, the first judge, like, that was what they were requesting. They didn't want probation. They didn't want jail time. They wanted me banned, cannot even go into the District of Columbia. And the judge...
Is there legal precedent for that? I've not heard of that. And I mean, of all the protests that happened in D.C., an entire summer of love, I've not heard of that.
There have been some instances where felons, people who are felons or facing felony charges, have had a ban from the territory known as the District of Columbia. I think it may have even been a part of a few probation cases. It's extremely rare. It's usually for people that have felony charges or they're being investigated for terrorism, something on the violent side. Obviously, that's not me. I have no history of violence. I have no violent crime charges ever. So as you can imagine, my lawyer was stunned hearing that. And the judge was stunned hearing that. And he said, this is an egregious assault on Mr. Schroyer's First Amendment. I'm not going to allow this. I can't be. I've never even heard anything like this. So, and you know, this is how the court system goes. I've been through it so much now. I've actually learned a lot. I feel like I could be a lawyer. But so they can request a new judge. So the prosecution requests a new judge. We move into a new courtroom like 30 minutes later. And in front of this judge, he ratchets down what he wants. And he wants, like, I don't remember if it was a full ban from D.C., but it was another thing where, like, you can't come to D.C., you can't be at the Capitol. And the second judge was like, nope, not going to do it. First Amendment violation. So then we get in front of the third judge. And the request he makes with the third judge is that, and this has become a big talking point for people covering my case, and most people get it wrong, but essentially, if you read the actual probation document, it says, I cannot be in the Capitol with the intent to disrupt. So in other words, my probation, while I was waiting out the suspension of sentence and finishing my community service hours, the probation was I couldn't go disrupt Congress again. I couldn't go into a congressional hearing and stand up and disrupt the proceedings. That's what my probation was. Okay, so I'll explain why this is relevant with January 6th. So I'm in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, covering this event for InfoWars. And we, for the matters of the legalese here, obviously wanted the congressional proceedings to go forth that day. We wanted the election laws that were changed in the name of COVID with the mail-in ballots and the lack of voter ID and everything else. We wanted that proceeding to go on. We wanted that hearing to go on, because we were skeptical of the 2020 election results. So that's what we were there. We were there covering that day. And really, if I'm talking about what I wanted politically to happen, I wanted the hearings to happen. So the U.S. government files an indictment in August of 2021 against me. And it's a 21-page document. And 17 of the 21 pages are not even about January 6th. They're about my original disruption of Congress charges. So this is where the media gets it wrong. They claim that I violated my probation from my charges before. It's blatantly wrong. When you read the probation, it says it clearly states with intent to disrupt congressional hearing. I had no intent. Not to mention, if you look at the chronology, by the time that myself and Alex and the InfoWars crew even got to the Capitol grounds, they had already stopped the hearing. It was already stopped. So you couldn't even claim that I had anything to do with it, even if you wanted to make that claim. But obviously the media doesn't matter. This doesn't matter to the media. They don't look at this stuff. They just want to go with whatever narrative when they're attacking whatever right-wing conservative or journalist or commentator for that day. So now the FBI has nothing to really charge me for on January 6th. I was there. That's it. I never went into the Capitol. I never touched a police officer. I never engaged in any violence or anything like that. I was just there. So
you weren't even in the building itself.
No, never went into the building. And we're actually on film, and they had to recognize this in their documents that we're actually on film with our security team, who a lot of them are former police officers, former DC police officers, military veterans. And we actually tried to stop people from going to the Capitol. We tried to stop people from being violent that day. That's all on record. That's all in the court record. They had to recognize that. So they really didn't have anything on me for January 6th. So their hook was these older charges that all would have been gone by now if it wasn't for COVID. So now they indict me. Now they bring me to the court. I have to turn myself in. I spend a day in the federal prison in downtown Austin, Texas. And, you know, they read me all the charges and everything else. Okay. Now I'm back on my suspension of sentence, back on the same probation, and we're in and out of court for like a year and a half or 2 years even. It was a very long process, very long drawn out process. Well, and this is where we'll get into the Supreme Court case. So finally, I mean, the truth is I felt the best legal decision for me was to take a plea deal, because I was either going to face multiple charges, of which would have resulted in multiple years in prison. I would have faced multiple charges in a DC courtroom, likely with a jury of liberals that hate my guts, or I could take a plea deal to a lesser trespassing charge, entering and remaining on restricted government property. It's a lesser trespassing charge. It's a very minor misdemeanor. And I could have pled guilty to that. And the deal that basically we cut with the feds, and people get this wrong too, but the deal we cut with the feds was that I would cooperate with them and they wouldn't seek jail time. And that would be normal for a misdemeanor charge like this. You don't go to jail. So what was my cooperation? They wanted electronic documents. They wanted to take my cell phone. So I turned over everything that they wanted to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that myself or any of my colleagues or anybody that I talked to had nothing to do with any violence, no plans of violence, no plans of insurrection, of overthrowing the government or whatever on January 6th. So I said, no problem. Here, take everything. I have nothing to hide. I don't care. This will prove my innocence beyond a reasonable doubt. And it'll prove all of my associates, including one Alex Jones, with all my communications with him that they have access to, that he had nothing to do with any of this either. So we did that. I also sat down for a questioning and answer session with the FBI. They just wanted to know about events from January 6th, whatever. It was fine enough. So I did everything. And the understanding was that the prosecution was going to enter their sentencing recommendation of maybe some probation, but I'd already served probation for almost 4 years. So we were thinking this was going to be it. The thing was going to be a wrap. They filed their sentencing hearing, and they're asking for, I think it was 6 months in jail and another 2 years on probation. And we were stunned. We were like, what the hell? This is not what the deal we entered into here. This is not what my attorney is saying. This is not what my client agreed to when we went through all these rings and hoops to jump through because of your request. So, okay. And we learn a little something along the way here too, as the process plays out. But nonetheless, what we believe happened is same thing that happened to me when I was sitting outside a Capitol building after I disrupted the Trump impeachment hearing. They get a call from the higher ups. So they're the Biden administration or Nancy Pelosi, or whoever, they're not there on the ground engaging in the day to day. But when they reach the finish line, they pick up the phone and they say, oh, you cut what deal with Schroer? No, that's not how this is going to go. He's going to prison. You're going to make an example of him. So nonetheless, what ends up happening is, and this looks to be the case, at least with this judge, is the prosecution goes for 10 miles and then the judge says, oh, well, I'll just give you 5. So the judge is like, oh, I'm reasonable. He basically every time gives half of what the prosecuting attorneys, the U.S. attorneys, are asking for. So that's kind of the little game of back and forth that seems to be going on as far as the sentencing recommendations and then the sentencing from the judge. So I end up spending 2 months in prison. I'm still on probation. As far as anybody can tell, and when I was in prison, I talked to the warden. I talked to other officers in there, people that have been in the Bureau of Prisons for decades. They've never seen or heard of anybody with a misdemeanor in a federal prison. I was in there with lifers, people who spent decades in prison as inmates. Never heard or seen of anybody in there with a misdemeanor. My nickname was Misdemeanor because of that, because I'm the only one that they've ever heard of with a misdemeanor.
Well, I mean, and I think to really drive home this point, you ended up in a federal prison for months for what they claim was trespassing.
Well, and so this is where we'll get into the Supreme Court case that we have coming up. And I'll just conclude this thought real quick. So the point is, I'm basically being treated like a top tier felon. They get access to my bank records like I'm a money launderer or a racketeer. I'm not. I do urine analysis screening for drugs, like I have drug charges or I'm a drug dealer. I'm not. So, I mean, I have to go through all of this crap. Like, I'm treated like a high level felon. I have a lesser trespassing charge, a misdemeanor. Okay, so here's what we're getting into now. In the sentencing recommendation, and this is why we're taking this to the Supreme Court, all they have on me from January 6th is speech. And they claim, and this is the shocking part, and this is actually in their sentencing recommendation, and the judge eventually agreed with it. The criminal speech that I uttered on January 6th in Washington, D.C., was I chanted 1776 and I chanted USA. I'm not even kidding you. That's in their document. And it's Twilight Zone level. As I'm sitting in the courtroom, I could hear the Twilight Zone theme song in the background as the U.S. attorneys approach the judge's bench and say, Mr. Schroyer chanted 1776. Mr. Schroyer chanted USA. I mean, it was eerie that they're arguing to the judge that that's worthy of incarceration. Now, okay. Not only were they citing, because that's all they have on January 6th. Again, never went to the Capitol, never assaulted a police officer, never. I mean, you could say I entered in restricted government grounds. It's a lesser misdemeanor trespassing charge. Nobody goes to jail for this. Most of the time, they just cut it from the courtroom. They're just done with it. They don't even want to deal with it. So to enhance my sentence, and this is why we're going to the Supreme Court, to enhance my sentence, the argument of why I needed to be in prison, why I needed to be incarcerated, they took speech from my show on InfoWars from before and after the election that had nothing to do with January 6th and had nothing to do with my charges. Me claiming that Joe Biden was an agent for the Chinese communists, me claiming that Joe Biden had mental problems and maybe dementia. They even said that I was not remorseful enough for claiming that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. And so they're citing things from early 2020. They're citing things from late 2021, having nothing to do with my charges, nothing to do with January 6th. So this is why we're ultimately taking my case to the Supreme Court, because the insinuation or the legal precedent that you can take speech that has nothing to do with the charges and use that as a sentencing enhancement or a reason for incarceration is extremely dangerous. Now, this might be a mundane example, but this is the precedent we're talking about. If you get pulled over for a traffic violation, let's say you get pulled over, you're going 75 and a 65, and the policeman walks over to your car and says, you know, I see right here that you said something about Joe Biden last month, or I see something here that you said you think Jerry Nadler is corrupt last month. I'm going to have to write you a citation. You'd say, what? Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why are you citing something that has nothing to do with this? And now you're going to write me a speeding ticket. Now, there's some legal precedent where if I said something publicly like, hey, I love speeding, I'm going to make sure I break the law and go too fast on the road today. Well, then they could enter that into the record and say, okay, look, you know, there's proof that there was a prior conception to committing this crime. So if maybe they had me saying a month before, I'm going to go into the Capitol or I'm going to start a riot at the Capitol, then maybe they could use that in a sentencing recommendation. But even that's a little hairy. Even that's been questioned before dealing with sentencing. My speech had nothing to do with it. So we're taking my case to the Supreme Court because this is what we're trying to stop the precedent from happening, that any speech you make that has nothing to do with the charges you're facing, nothing to do with what you're in court for, can be used against you by a prosecuting attorney, by a U.S. attorney, and by a judge to enhance your sentence and to give reason for your incarceration. That cannot stand. We filed my petition last week. All we need is four Supreme Court justices to be willing to hear the case, and then we actually get to argue it in front of the Supreme Court. So that's the case here. This isn't even, I'm not trying to claim that I'm innocent of anything. This isn't me trying to relitigate my charges. The reason we're going to the Supreme Court is to have this precedent and have the Supreme Court review the idea that somehow prior speech that has nothing to do with your charges can be used as a sentencing enhancement, because that's a very dangerous concept.
And it's not just that they have nothing to do with your charges, but it's also a complete. How you're prone to criminality. Those things are legally protected. They're I mean, it's the fact that they would bring them up at all. I mean, they're trying to show malicious intent based on a biased interpretation of what they think happened in the elections, which they're allowed to think, but they're not allowed to use that, or they shouldn't be allowed to use that as the reason why you should go to prison.
Well, and the whole thing was eerie, too, because they basically said that to the judge. They even admitted that when they were arguing to the judge. But then it would be like this. I mean, I'm telling you, it was Twilight Zone in my head. Me and my lawyer kept looking at each other, like touching each other, like, wait, are you here? Is this a dream? Is this a nightmare? Because the U.S. attorney would get up at the podium and say, just to be clear, this happened probably five times. Just to be clear, because our argument was free speech, obviously. They'd say, well, just to be clear, this is not about Mr. Schroyer's speech, but here's what Schroyer said. I mean, it happened like five times. I mean, the transcript is public. People can go read it. And I'm just sitting here like, what? This isn't about Mr. Schroyer's speech, but here's what he said. And it happened at least five times during the sentencing hearing. So we just want to make sure that this precedent cannot be used against anybody. And it could be mm-hmm. political. It could be for personal beef. It could be for any number of reasons that something you said, which is already your protected First Amendment right, would be used against you for charges that have nothing to do with what you said. It's just incredible stuff.
No, I think the precedent there, we can't overstate how terrifying it is. Could you imagine? I mean, for example, you're maybe going through family court and the lawyer starts to say, by the way, did you know that this is what he said on Twitter, or these are his thoughts about the 2020 election? I mean, essentially it's legally sanctioned character assassination that actually has consequences for the outcome of what should be an unbiased legal system. So it's terrifying. I want to talk to you a little bit more about the state of free speech in America, because we're simultaneously seeing things like the anti-Semitism awareness bill pass the House. And also, sorry, one thing I want to bring up, all of those, you know, Antifa folks who are actually trying to lay siege against federal buildings, in the Pacific Northwest. Do you know any of them who went to federal prison? Because I don't.
No. And when we were kind of preparing our stance on this, we did a lot of research. You know, because when we first we tried to have the case dismissed with clear bias. And I think that is clearly bias, because, again, you can just juxtapose. David Hogg stood up during a gun hearing and made some anti-gun diatribe, and he got hauled out of the room and he didn't face anything. It's not a single thing. They let him go. He never went to prison. He was never going to go to prison. So, I mean, we had all kinds of examples of selective prosecution is what it's called. So we really leaned more into the examples where people would disrupt congressional hearings and nothing would happen, because that was a little more relevant to my case. But no, I did spend more time, because we did look into some of that. I did spend more time in prison than even most people that got caught rioting with Antifa or Black Lives Matter during the 2020 riots. Many of them had their charges dropped. Many of them just went on probation and didn't even have to go to jail at all.
No, I mean, I think this goes to show that the idea that we've seen it, like, I've heard Republicans say we shouldn't, you know, with the BLM protesters, we shouldn't go so hard after them because we don't want to, you know, essentially use the court system as a political cudgel. The court system is a political cudgel, whether people on the right now want to admit it or similarly take part in it as well. And I think you're a great example of that. We have a lot more to talk about with Owen, but I do want to say a big thank you to today's sponsor, Books, because you guys, Mother's Day is coming up. It's May 12th. So you still got some time. It's not too late to get something online. Let your mom know that you're the time to say thank you for. So take this as an opportunity. This Mother's Day, give mom her flowers. She deserves the best. And that's why I'm sending Farm Fresh Flowers from Books. That is short for bouquets. And exciting stuff. I got you guys 25% off your entire Books purchase. So you can send her some too. That is why I love the Books. Best flower farms grown on these designs and unique flowers you can't find anywhere else. So none of this cookie cutter stuff. And finally, Books It's simple. You can go online, pick out your, even if your mom is far away from you, you can still send her flowers as if you're right there with her. So again, Mother's Day, May 12th. Right. So there's a lot of things that are happening in the country regarding free speech, not just cases like yours, unfortunately, Owen. But we also see that simultaneously, the House has just passed what they are calling the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. I mean, we all want to be a brief or even an expression of Christianity as actually anti-Semitism. So what are your thoughts there on the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act?
It's got to be the most aggressive legislation against the First Amendment that we've ever seen. I mean, I definitely in modern history, I don't think there's been anything like this that is so aggressively against the First Amendment. And, you know, I think there's a couple things playing out here. You know, there is a natural human tendency that I think has had now confirmation bias, or as the saying goes, find out who you're not allowed to criticize, and that's who rules over you. So this idea that we need to stop a conspiracy theory that a Jewish mafia runs the world, or that somehow Zionism controls your country, that making this bill is going to quell that rhetoric. If anything, it's just going to enhance it or even confirm it. So it's going to have the reverse intended effect to such an obvious level that you wonder if that's not even being done intentionally, because it's that egregious. But aside from that, there's so many different angles to take. There's no legislation, and people love to point this out, but it's true. I can go on X, or I can make public statements against white people, black people, Christians, Islamophobes. I might be called names, or I might get judged for that, but there's no legislation that says it's illegal. Nobody would argue that somehow that is illegal speech, but now they're arguing that criticism of one group in particular, in this case, Jewish individuals, is somehow now illegal. And so again, aside from any double standards that we could point out to here, it's only going to confirm in people's minds these theories of the powerful Zionist lobby, the powerful Israeli lobby. And I just wonder, is it meant to create more anti-Semitism for more crackdown on speech? Are the powers that be from the Israel lobby that desperate because they're losing the narrative, especially dealing with what's going on in the Gaza Strip? But those are kind of the outliers here. We're talking about a direct assault on free speech. You hate speech is free speech. That doesn't mean we have to agree with it. That doesn't mean we have to like it, but it is free speech. I mean, there have been cases brought to the Supreme Court specifically dealing with Nazi speech or performances, or KKK speech or performances being labeled as hate speech. And yet it has been held up that that is still First Amendment protected activity. So you really have to wonder, why now? Why now are they trying to pass this bill? The timing is certainly not irrelevant considering what's going on in the Middle East, in the Gaza Strip, and what's happening with political commentary right now, where people are talking about the Israeli lobby and its influence over our Congress. And all this bill does is completely confirm that that's really what's going on. And you don't have to look much further than who gets funded by AIPAC to realize, oh, that's how they get these bills passed. That's how they get all of these congressmen to be so supportive of Israel to such a degree that it would even seem that their main priority is Israel's sovereignty and security, more so even than the United States of America. So it really doesn't even matter where you stand on the Israel issue. I think these are neutrally observable facts. And anybody that doesn't want to address these as facts is just not being intellectually honest. And I've noticed that there's a lot of people on the right that don't want to be intellectually honest about this either, for two reasons. One, it's traditional, I think, of a conservative political, let's say, value to stand for Israel and Two, there's many people on the right that are just as controlled as the left. I mean, it really is the right-left paradigm where there are many people on the right who will only do what it is to oppose the left. So if the left comes out and is anti-Israel, well, then naturally they just have to be pro-Israel, and that's the stance they're going to take because the left is anti-Israel. Well, that's very low IQ, and you're just as able to be controlled as the left is when you have a philosophy in politics like that. So that's what I'm seeing going on. But to me, these are neutrally observable things. Any criticism of any group of people or skin color or anything like that, nobody's ever signed legislation to stop it. That's just a fact. I would even say it's a neutrally observable fact that law enforcement's response to Antifa or Black Lives Matter, really since 2016, you could even go back to the Michael Brown riots in Ferguson. That I was boots on the ground covering those. There has never been a heavy-handed police response like what we've seen to these anti-Israel protests that happened right here at UT. I was there for that one. And the truth is they weren't getting violent. Once the police showed up, yep, there was some violence and there were some assaults on police. That's a criminal activity. Take them down. If you're blocking highways, if you're blocking entrances to buildings or public spaces, that's a crime. You get arrested. So, you know, it's a difficult thing, but law enforcement is hard. So I think these are neutrally observable facts. The crackdown on the anti-Israel protests has been much more heavy-handed than the actual riots that we saw as recently as 2020. But conservatives want to act like, oh, that's not true. To me, that's a neutrally observable fact. And if you're not able to recognize that, then you're not being intellectually honest. And to a certain degree, I think you've been brainwashed.
Right. And I think several things can be true at the same time. I can look at cops hauling away dirty hippie college students and have a smile on my face, but also question, where was this swift and decisive police response during the summer of love, right? When we actually had buildings being burned down, when even on campuses, we had all of these insane protests, where was this same concern? And now to play devil's advocate, because I'm not gonna, I've made a video about the bill. I think it's garbage. I think it's an assault to free speech. I've heard people say in response to that, though, hang on a second, Lauren, hang on, Owen. No one is saying that the speech is illegal. You can still say these things, but it's simply that, you know, you are not, as a institution of higher learning, then going to be eligible for federal funding. Is that a meaningful distinction these people are making in defense of the bill, that they're not saying we're going to haul you off to prison for saying these things?
It's crime and punishment. So you could argue that we're not trying to put you in jail, but it's still crime and punishment. They're still insinuating that anti-Semitic speech is a crime and it needs to be punished. So I'm not listening to that. I'm not hearing that. It's totally illegitimate. And isn't it amazing? We really find out from supposed free speech advocates. I mean, I think the left has kind of already showed their hand as far as where they really stand on free speech. They don't really stand for it at all. But now you're even seeing on the right supposed free speech advocates. I guess they have a line in the sand as well. I guess they have a certain viewpoint that they view that, nope, I guess that does not get considered free speech. So it's been a good thing, to be quite honest. I think it's been a good thing. And this happens usually in an election year. There's kind of a purge. This maybe a purge isn't the right word to use here, but a purifying process that we go through every election cycle. So every other year, even more so in a presidential year, where people expose their true colors, and people will lose audience members. They'll gain audience members depending on where they fall on certain issues. But there have been a lot of people. I mean, you can even go back and just deal with the whole Israel situation in general, where I think, I mean, you look at Ben Shapiro, he has lost a lot of respect in the conservative media, where he once was a well-respected conservative commentator. A lot of people have very little or no respect for him anymore for some of the stances he's taken. So I think
I think with Ben Shapiro, it's interesting because I'm looking at his like his YouTube channel. He's still, you know, over the past few months, his views seem consistent, but I think there's now like a big divide between certain people in the conservative movement, because 2016, a lot of young people like Ben Shapiro. He's doing those rec feminism videos. He's going viral for a lot of that stuff. I think he's sparked a conservative awakening in a lot of younger people. I don't want to take that away from him, but I look at the same, I guess, age demographic now, and I'm seeing a lot more anti-Ben Shapiro sentiment. Like, I'm not seeing Zoomers who are huge Ben Shapiro fans. I'm not seeing the people in their mid-20s who are just so excited about Ben Shapiro. I'm still seeing a lot of support for him, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, and up. But I think that they're, like, a lot of the fragmenting of the conservative movement, specifically over this issue, it is falling along, like, age lines.
There's no doubt it's a generational issue. No doubt. I think that younger people are less inclined to have this or this feeling of a moral obligation to Israel or some sort of foreign policy approach that we need to back Israel. And I really think it comes down to one thing and one thing simply. Young Americans are looking at their country and their future, and they have their own issues. They don't want to be on the hook for Israel's issues anymore. They don't want to be in the hook for Ukraine's issues anymore. They don't want to be on the hook for any foreign interests or country's issues anymore. We have our own issues here. And I think that younger generations feel that they've been sold out by the mainstream media, by our politicians. And it just so happens, it's undeniable. Look at the money that AIPAC spends. Look at the influence that Israel has in our foreign policy. It's undeniable that Israel is one of these nations that the United States wholly supports. And I think what I observe as just somebody that consumes media in a mass scale, when I'm watching a Ben Shapiro or I'm watching another example might be a Mark Levin, they can make a lot of great points and they say a lot of things that I agree with. And they've got a lot of good, let's say, legal takes with their legal expertise. But what is, again, to me, neutrally observable, I'm just using these two people as an example because they're some of the bigger names out there. They've been around and it's a generational thing. But Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin will go on unhinged diatribes with more passion and fervor in support of Israel than anything they ever cover from an American perspective, than any issue they ever cover dealing with American domestic issues or policy. And so when I see that, just for me, that, and I consume media that I agree with and disagree with. I have no problem with that. But to me, that's a storyteller. To me, that's a big storyteller. And I have no problem if you're a Jew for Israel First. No problem with that at all. In fact, I know many of them. I talk to them every day. I have no problem with that. But if you're going to prop yourself up and you're going to posture yourself as an American First conservative, as a diehard, you know, conservative American patriot, and you're going to lead that thought movement and you're going to lead that conservative values push in the media. But then when any issue dealing with Israel pops up, that becomes your biggest issue. Well, then you're just a fraud. I mean, you're just a fraud. There's no other way to put it. And people don't like frauds. And I think with Shapiro, you're even dealing with a level of cowardice, and he's been exposed now by Candace Owens. And he sits here and projects like, oh, we'll have this debate. But then they're going through all these different levels behind the scenes to make sure the debate never happens. So again, whenever you deal with fraud and cowardice, immediately you're going to lose respect. And immediately you're going to start losing the narrative and you're going to start losing the plot. And so that's what I think goes on here. Now, what's unfortunate is that these college smelly hippies, as you put them, probably quite accurately, they have now properly served as the perfect distraction from an actual issue. And right. So instead of actually talking about what's going on in the Gaza Strip, instead of actually talking about whatever warranted or unwarranted Israel has on our foreign policy or on our media or on our Congress, we're not talking about that now. We're talking about brainwashed liberal protesters that bought an Islamic headscarf off Amazon and are now walking around campus with it on, thinking they're trendy, thinking they look good. And now they have served as a perfect distraction away from the actual conversation that needs to be had. So it's what happens every time. We could have a real conversation about criminal justice reform. We could have a real conversation about law reform in this country. And then they just go out and they chant, all cops are bad, and start burning police stations down. Now you've distracted from having a real conversation.
I think it has been illuminating in a way, because once these protests started, we immediately see that, okay, the university administration, it's cracking down on it, right? I mean, it's not like a BLM thing where you actually have like universities officially saying Black Lives Matter, we're going to adopt this same stance. And we've seen that when university officials the one with the plagiarism, when that does happen, then they are now attacked. So it's a blatant double standard as to how things are dealt with when we actually want to shut it down. We also saw that even donors, when it came to these anti-Israel protests, they're now even saying, I'm not going to be funding your school unless you stop this. We have legislators saying, we are not going to be giving you federal funding unless you stop this. So how long have these universities acted as hotbeds against white people, against men, against American nationalism, right? I mean, for over a generation at this point, none of these steps were taken to stop it. And I think that's what people really need to understand. There is the political ability to make all of these like cultural Marxist centers change their tune. There's simply no will toward it. And that's what's frustrating to me, at least. Like, yeah, if we want to say all hands on deck, like fix the issue, that's fine, I suppose. But why do we not still have the same unity, the same intentness to solve a problem when it's, you know, white men who are under attack? That's what's been kind of illuminating to me. And oftentimes, I think a lot of the same people who are saying we need to shut down these protests, they're bad, let's do more. When it comes to actually dealing with, again, like the anti-white discrimination, these are oftentimes the same people who are saying, no, we don't want to be better than the left. We don't want to embrace authoritarianism ourselves. And it's like, oh, well, changed your tune pretty quickly there. Claudine Gay, that's it. Yeah.
But to me, that's just a neutrally observable fact. I mean, it's just true. And they even have it in the curriculum, you know, anti-white rhetoric. They have college spaces for BIPOCs only. In other words, white's not allowed. So this has been allowed to go on. And we all know that the left is basically running these universities. And so that's why we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, traditionally, the left has been more anti-Israel than the right. I think that the young right might be considered anti-Israel now. They take a more philosophical, intellectual, political approach to it, obviously. They're not out in the streets with, you know, their Amazon-purchased Islamic headscarf for Instagram. But nonetheless, so it's a leftist problem. And what's funny about this is we went from, as Trump supporters in the United States, we went from Nazis, they would call us Nazis, and they would call us anti-Semites. If you wore a Make America Great Again hat, they'd say you're an anti-Semite, you're a Nazi. Well, now the left is blatantly anti-Semitic. Like, they're not even hiding it. They're chanting death to Jews and all this other crap. I mean, blatantly anti-Semitic. They're embracing the kind of traditional Muslim Arab world versus Israel versus Jews. And they're going with the Islam Arab world versus Jews side of this thing. I mean, so they went from, hey, everybody in a Trump has an anti-Semite, to blatant anti-Semites, blocking Jews from going into their college courses without even blinking an eye, Lauren. It wasn't even a blip on their radar as they pointed here at their political opposition, anti-Semite, anti-Semite, anti-Semite. And then they actually went full anti-Semite. And it was just like, they didn't even hesitate.
There is this now viral video of, there is a college student with a keffiyeh. Not a keffiyeh. He's wearing the yarmulke. The other side are wearing the keffiyehs. And it's one of those areas where the students have like made a pro-Palestine zone. I don't know. The student is trying to get through. They're refusing him because they say something along the lines of, I'm sorry, but we can't trust your intentions. And I don't even know if this specific student was a Zionist or not. And you actually, on some of these college campuses, you do have groups like Jews for Peace, Jews for Free Palestine, who are Jewish, but anti the Israeli military action right now. But here's the thing. When you start conflating being Jewish with being a Zionist, Jews and Israel, you do open yourself up to these types of situations. And I bring this up because I've been critical of Israel and been called an anti-Semite. We see people on the right who try to conflate those two things, but you know, they try to do it in defense of Israel, but that actually, I think, hurts Jewish people every day, because there are a lot of people who wouldn't have a problem with, you know, their Jewish neighbor, who do have a problem with what's going on in Israel. You don't want to try to smear them as just being bigoted, because if you reinforce that conflation of Israel with Jewish people, that's not going to end well for Jewish people. Absolutely not.
Well, but this whole idea that criticizing Israel somehow makes you an anti-Semite is again, it's just not intellectually honest. I criticize the American government every day. I mean, most of my show, I'm criticizing Joe Biden or border policy or all kinds of different issues. Does anybody claim I'm anti-American? No, I do it because I'm a patriot. So it's just, it's not logical. It's not honest. And, you know, that's what's really frustrating, Lauren. When you get into political commentary, you really realize how much dishonesty there is, and how many times people will just throw logic and honesty out the window. And many times it's just for money. It's just for money. It's just for fame. It's for popularity. And, you know, I'm not trying to lean into some of these issues, but there's certain examples that you can use. And I'll understand all sides of it when they're clearly explained to me. But here's an example. And I know you mentioned earlier that we might get into this, but, you know, Tim Pool is afraid to talk about some things on his show. And he explains why. He's honest about it. He's like, look, I don't want to get banned from YouTube. And Tim Pool has a large staff of people. He employs a lot of people. He's probably thinking about them. So again, I'm not leaning into any sides of this issue. It's just when people explain their stances, then I understand it. So yeah, there's things that Tim Pool doesn't want to talk about on his show. And I think I went on a show and I might have said tranny or something. And he kind of, you know, his face kind of puckered up when I said that on his live show. So I get it. That's Tim Pool's stance. He wants to be on YouTube. He doesn't want to get banned. So he kind of caters his content to exist in that realm. And this is just an example. But that's what I'm saying is people will be dishonest, or they won't engage in true logic because they know, well, I either have to have this stance on this issue to stay here, or I have to take this stance on this issue to keep my money for my campaign incoming. So I would just appreciate some transparency and some honesty. And I think when you don't get that's when you have this whole, well, all these people are Zionists or all these people are anti-Semites. No, you can be critical of Israel's government. You can be critical of Israel's military strategy. That doesn't make you, it doesn't even necessarily make you anti-Israel. Mm. Certainly not anti-Semitic.
Right. Well, I mean, we have Charlie Kirk, who is one of the, I think, loudest, most out Israel supporters you could imagine. But he did have questions about the events leading up, you know, to October 7th, you know, the slow response from the IDF, lack of intelligence. These are questions that he raised, because obviously Israeli intelligence is, I mean, top of the planet when it comes to their knowledge of potential threats against the country. So the fact that this did end up happening and it took so long to respond, it's something people have raised questions about. He even was called an anti-Semite for raising a lot of the same questions that eventually Israeli media themselves would be asking. And there's a lot of now pushback, I think, against Netanyahu, specifically for the fact that some people view this as at least partly his fault, not that he, you know, pulled the trigger himself, but that he could have done more to stop it. He's been now Charlie Kirk is being called an anti-Semite for saying this. And it's like, I'm sorry, but if the bar is such that even Charlie Kirk could be called an anti-Semite, then you're basically saying no criticism at all is allowed against Israel. That's what that comes off to me.
Well, and I think Charlie Kirk just makes a pretty easily neutrally observable, you know, commentary here, which is, yeah, how does Israel, with the number one security state in the Middle East and intelligence in the Middle East, how do they have October 7th happening? I mean, I've reached my conclusion. I think it's pretty obvious, and there's enough information out there now that there was a stand down, and it's because Netanyahu wants to have his legacy be the conquering of the Gaza Strip, essentially. He wants Israel to have the Gaza Strip. I think that's why they're moving into East Rafah right now. They might leave like the southern tip of Rafah for the Palestinians, and then they'll probably relocate like 500,000 of them to the West, Europe, the United States of America. It appears that that's the situation. I even think that there's backroom deals going on between Israel and Iran right now, and all of this saber rattling that they're doing for the public consumption is just that. I think they've cut backroom deals as well, and I mean, because let's be honest, we're not seeing any serious response from the world. We're not seeing any serious response from the Arab world. We're not seeing any serious response from the UN or the ICC. There's a bunch of rhetoric, a bunch of saber rattling. And then it's kind of like when you walk by the homeless people, like, you know, before going to a ball game or downtown, it's like, yeah, you see that person is there starving on the side of the road, and but you don't do anything. You just kind of walk on. It's like, oh, wow, look, a starving person. Okay, we're just going to move on. So it feels like that's kind of the real approach towards this situation in the Gaza Strip. So no, I think my conclusion is that Israel stood down. They wanted this to be their excuse to go into the Gaza Strip and essentially conquer it. And Netanyahu wants his legacy to be expanding the Israeli state to the beachfront property in eastern Rafah, in eastern Gaza. And it appears at this point that's exactly what is going to happen. And nobody is doing anything to stop it. So does that make me anti-Semitic for making what appeared to me to be obvious geopolitical observations? No, but I guess if you're trying to protect a certain narrative, then yeah, you want to label anybody an anti-Semite because that's your way of somehow discrediting their commentary.
Right. Well, there is one post that I want to highlight. I'll fight you naked. Keeping left and right fighting about Israeli war justification is intentionally keeping us from what most agree is strange. Why are we paying for it? Great question. And, you know, you kind of mentioned homelessness, a homeless starving person on the side of the road there. Speaking of that, you're familiar with Austin. Speaking with Savannah Hernandez a couple of weeks ago, I brought up that I was recently there, shocked by the homelessness. Apparently, people from Austin say that it's better than it used to be, which is crazy to me. And you know, the idea that we're talking about America sending billions and billions of dollars abroad, whether that be to Israel, to Ukraine, to Taiwan, when meanwhile you have American cities that actually look worse than third world cities that I have been to. Like, I grew up in Asia. I've been to many third world countries. Some American cities are worse. I'll say it. Like, I would much rather be in Bangkok than in Austin at this point, or definitely not San Francisco. Like, what do you think the average person in Austin is thinking when they're looking at what their city is? Like, are people in cities just so desensitized to it at this point that it seems normal?
Well, you know, we kind of try to put makeup on the pig or like a Band-Aid over it, and we'll build a new, you know, now multi-billion dollar sports complex. And it's like, oh, wow, look, we got a brand new sports complex. We're doing fine. But you pass, you know, 50 homeless people strung out on drugs and starving on your way to the stadium. Yeah, what happened in Austin was they signed a bill a few years back making it legal to basically encamp anywhere you want. And so Austin kind of became the homeless hotbed, certainly for Texas, but people from all over the nation were actually moving to Austin because you could pop up a tent anywhere. The hike and bike trails on the riverfront, a nice popular recreational area, Lady Bird Lake. I mean, just right downtown, and some of these other districts like Riverside. And so it got really bad for a couple years, and then they had to change the law and they made it illegal again. So what you saw was definitely probably 10% of what it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And they even had a plan, I believe this was in 2014, where, because Austin was getting the most funding and they had the most infrastructure for the homeless, they have this building downtown known as the Arch, which the homeless don't actually like to stay at because you can't do drugs there. So they'll go there for their meal 3 times a day, but then they'll go stay out on the streets so they can do their drugs. But they moved the homeless from Houston and Dallas and San Antonio to Austin at the hopes that this homeless infrastructure that they built here and these centers would kind of solve the problem. And of course, it had the reverse effect as intended. But getting back to the real issue, and this goes with the larger issue that we were talking about earlier with the generational deal. Yes, America has its own problems. And I don't care what side of the Israel issue that you're on. And I actually went to UT a couple of weeks ago when these protests first started kicking off. And I tried to instill this point into the crowd that, look, we can all agree on one thing. We're sick of our money being spent on foreign interests and foreign wars and foreign countries. This is what, right after they passed the $100 billion national security bill, not for our national security, but for other countries. And so we have our own infrastructure problems. We have our own security problems with the southern border. We've defunded our police, which has resulted in the increase of violent crime in the inner cities. Homelessness is up. Now, some people choose to be homeless, but it's still an issue. What about veteran homelessness? I mean, you know, the left is always clamoring for things like free health care, which I completely disagree with. But it's like, if I was left with two options, $100 billion for foreign countries or $100 billion for U.S. health care, I'd go with U.S. health care. Now, again, I'd rather not fund either of it with taxpayer dollars, but that's
right. But if you're going to spend money, it should be, if you're going to spend American taxpayer money, I think it makes sense to spend it on Americans. I think
Israel has health care. We pay for it. Israel has health care. We pay for it. And they have abortions and we pay for it. But I don't hear any conservatives complaining about that.
Right. No, that's and that's true. And it's interesting because I feel like there's more outrage sometimes from the right about, you know, maybe, and I'm talking about the Nikki Haley's, about spending money on Social Security for Americans than there is for sending money overseas. And I don't want to harp on Ben Shapiro too much, but he went viral within a week for saying that he doesn't like Social Security. It's a Ponzi scheme. We need to cut it, cut. But also that we should, it's in our best interest to send all this money to Ukraine, to Israel. It's like, do you not see why people would look at that and look at the Republican Party in general, because he's seen as someone as a spokesperson for Republicans and think, wow, you do not have our best interests at heart. And I'm not for just trying to pay people for votes. But if that's what the left's doing while simultaneously the right is saying, well, we're still going to take your money. It's just we're not going to give you anything for it. We're going to send it overseas. That's not much of a leg to stand on for Republicans. I do have some chats I want to get to. Not ex nice guy, Groypers. Love you, Lydia. Nick sends his love and thanks you for your base takes. The Northwest Passage, Dubot Super Chat 2. Groyper, we love you, Lauren. I feel like I've been missing out on the chat, you guys. Groypers in the house, apparently. Arcion says, I know Owen is not talking about all, but as a former homeless person, and I can say I never did drugs, and I chose to sleep outside because shelters aren't always safe. Homelessness is nuanced. I mean, fair enough, but I think there are, I mean, when we look at especially the endemic homeless problem that cities like Austin have, it does seem like you cannot divorce it from the drug problem and from like mental health issues more generally, even though like hashtag not all, but someone who was just there, it was pretty clear that there is a substance abuse issue that's very, very common for these people. So yeah, Owen, thank you so much for joining. I do know that you have to get going. Where can people keep up with you, your show, your takes, what you're up to?
Well, I'm live every day, 3 to 6 p.m. Central on InfoWars, band.video, InfoWars.com/show, AmericanElection.news, OwenSchroyer.show. Those are some of the links that you can go to. I'm not sure your internet browser or social media app might have one or two of those bands, so we have to have multiple options for you. 3 to 6 p.m. Central, I'm live. And I always keep people updated on what I'm up to on my X account, at OwenSchroyer1776. It's been nice to have that back since we were banned from everything some years ago. So it's nice for Elon Musk to allow me to be back on X, at OwenSchroyer1776. And I'm glad to be here, Lauren, after all these years fighting the good fight together as kind of some new members of the media. It's nice to finally collaborate with you, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And guys, the links to, at the very least, Owen's X account, as well as Schroyer.show or Owen's, one of those links is also in the description. So go ahead, make sure you're following him. He does a lot of great reporting on all these different issues. And for everyone who's joining us live, it's been great, you guys, in the chat, lighting it up. And we will see you next time, again, 11:30 a.m. Central, Wednesday, for Pseudo Intellectual Live. Take care.